antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model on the Kagami lattice. This is interesting because of the way order is usually thought of. There's the Landau theory, which tells us that order is associated with symmetry breaking. That's usually exemplified by the Mexican hat or the rotational symmetry breaking of an antiferromagnet. But in the 80s, it was realized in the fractional quantum Hall effect that order is not necessarily associated with symmetry breaking. There can be order without Born symmetry and without a local order parameter. And here, in our case, we're looking at frustrated magnets where competing spins, other spins, where there are competing interactions which cannot be simultaneously satisfied. These states, these systems can have different ground states, like paramagnetic disordered, conventional ordered with a local order parameter. Those are not the ones we're interested in today. A valence bond crystal, while more interesting, is also not the case. We are mostly interested in exotic order, like spin liquids and topological order today. So a valence bond crystal, as I said, is a bit more interesting. And that is because while it breaks the translational symmetry, it is an intrinsically quantum state because it's a covering of the system by singlet states of valence bonds. And if you now consider a superposition of different valence bond coverings, you arrive at something that Anderson in 73 called the resonating valence bond liquid. These days, most people talk about the nearest neighbor valence bond liquid, but in principle, you can have any distance valence bond in there. These quantum liquids have some very interesting properties, which you could talk for days about. Here we will skip to the most interesting part. First, why are we interested in them? Well, obviously, they are interesting in itself because they are outside of the known theory. They are ordered ground states which do not break any symmetry. They cannot be described by a local order parameter, and the order is related to the long-range entanglement, whereas, for example, a nearest state can be described with short-range entanglement. In the 80s, Anderson proposed this valence bond liquids to be connected to high-temperature superconductivity, and also these days it's more interesting because of the possible connection to fault-tolerant quantum computing due to their topological properties. It was soon realized that to get spin liquids, we need large quantum fluctuations which destroy any ordering that the system might have. So we need small spin, low coordination number, low dimension, strong frustration, and many degenerate ground states, classically degenerate ground states. The system we're looking at today is the Kagami system and the antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model on it. This first cropped up in 89 to describe helium on graphite. These days, most people talk about the Kagami model in relation to copper minerals like hubertsmithite, kapelasite, and it's a very promising candidate for a spin liquid ground state. The Kagami lattice is corner-shaped triangles and so named for the Japanese basket weave, which they apparently use to carry fish around. I don't know. But it's definitely not Kagami, but Kagome. And yeah, there's these hexagons and small triangles. And it's been in condensed matter theory for more than 20 years. There have been many proposals for the ground state of this system. These are just some of the papers. You could write a book about it easily, a couple of books. So for us, relevant today are the valence bond crystal, which was first proposed in 91, a gapped spin liquid, a Z2 spin liquid, which I think was first proposed by Suchdev for this system. Then, of course, chiral spin liquids and the gapless spin liquids. The valence bond crystal that was proposed for this system is a 36-site unit cell valence bond crystal, where you have perfect hexagons, which are packed as closely as possible, which creates this kind of pinwheel structure in the center. led to a fairly low energy in Sears expansion. Then there are the various quantum spin liquid proposals. Again, this is a topic which requires much deeper study to understand, but I think Xiao Gang can do that much better than I can. What's important for us here is that you can classify them, and you can do that by considering how to break the symmetry of the gauge fields. And this, for this system, leads basically to a couple of different proposals. For one, there's the gapless spin liquid without topological order, a gapped chiral spin liquid, which does have topological order, and of course, the gapped spin liquid, which doesn't have chiral ordering. So whenever theory can't help us, we're turning to numerics. This happened as early as, I think, 93 or 91 even. And the problem is, of course, small sample size. So it's very hard to determine what the system does in the thermodynamic limit. It wasn't clear, well, it was early on clear that the ground state was a disordered one without conventional ordering. But for example, the gaps were not, it wasn't clear whether they would stay open or would close. So they started using approximate methods like a diagonalization in a valence bond basis, contractor normalization, Monte Carlo methods, quantum dimer models, and Sears expansion. Many different methods, and they didn't exactly agree on what actually constituted the ground state. It looked like the valence bond crystal was winning. This continued in the last couple of years when advanced numerics brought this topic back and created new possible solutions. It started out with a DMRG study on torus systems, which, while numerically questionable, nevertheless brought a new answer to the discussion. This was, of course, instantly disputed by a tensor network study, which found a VBC, which is probably due to an inherent bias in the ansatz state that was used at that point. But the energy was a variational energy, which was competitive. Actually, the first time that a 2D tensor network method did that. I think it's still the way. Anyways, Goodswiller project in Monte Carlo, on the other hand, offered a gapless spin liquid again. And now we're coming to why I am talking here, because the next large study was the science paper by Steve White, where he did a very thorough, large-scale numerical study, and he tried to determine whether it was a valence bond crystal or a spin liquid. And he found very clear evidence for a spin liquid. So this brings us to this talk. We have...
The White's result is a gap, right?
Sorry?
The White's result is a gap.
Yes. I will talk about the gap in a bit, why we thought it was necessary to do our study. Because, well, we have a code which is a bit better than Steve's because we have non-abelian symmetries. And that is actually not a bit better, but a whole load better because it allows us to compute the spin gap in a very direct way without unnecessary approximations. And also we can reach larger systems and on the same system size as White, we could also reach higher precision. Higher precision enables us to also consider stuff like correlation functions. And also there were new tools coming up from quantum information theory, like the topological entanglement entropy, which were not used up to that point. And with all of that toolkit, we decided that we would try to determine the type of the spin liquid. We thought, huh, this would be a couple of weeks work, be done with it. It turns out this problem is a bit harder. I don't know how much you know about DMRG, but just to give you a quick introduction, it was invented by White in 92. If you are interested in the details, look into, for example, Schollberg's review from 2011, which gives a very up-to-date description of the method. It's basically an iterative optimization procedure for matrix product states. It can very efficiently determine the ground state of gapped systems. For gapless systems, it's a bit worse, but still works. For critical systems, it can fail. But still, it's to date the most successful method in one dimension. And that's due to the fact that the approximation is very well controlled by the matrix dimension. In fact, it's so well controlled that you can do an extrapolation in the matrix dimension. You shouldn't, but you can. And it's also been extended to finite temperatures and finite time scales with the TVD, for example. Today, though, we are talking about the extension to two dimensions. Since it scales with a fairly low power in the matrix dimension, we can reach very large systems. If you have very large systems, you can also think about arranging them in a weird way. And if you pick a weird way that mimics a two-dimensional lattice, you can actually describe two dimensions with that. So what you're doing is that instead of using that you put a one-dimensional snake through a two-dimensional lattice, which introduces long-range interactions. For example, here. These are nearest neighbor in two dimensions, but very long-range interaction in 1D. That's gonna cost, but it's possible. But what you have to keep in mind is that if we, for example, use periodic boundary conditions along this line so that we have a cylinder, we can do very long cylinders, whereas this direction here, in the vertical direction, is very expensive for us. If you increase in the vertical direction, every increase will increase the number of interactions and the amount of entanglement that this bond has to carry exponentially. Whereas if you increase in the linear direction, where you have the open boundary conditions, you will gain more bonds in the same way that you gain more interactions and entanglement. So the amount of entanglement interactions carried per bond remains constant. So that's a direction we can do very easily, as long as we have enough time, but it's possible. The other direction, exponentially costly, which is also why we have to take care not to use a torus. If you use a torus, so doubly periodic boundary conditions, both directions are expensive. For these systems, I can do about 700 sites. For a torus, I'm stuck at about 150. So here, we are going to use the SU2 symmetric implementation with a single site algorithm, which scales a bit better. We could do up to 5,000 SU2 states here, which is about 20,000 into one states. So that's a factor of 2 compared to earlier studies. Also, we did larger systems with a larger circumference. And this step from 12 to 17 is actually really, really expensive due to the exponential scaling. First, we started out again by mapping the system. This looks a bit weird, but it has some advantages, although it's not optimal. But it's just a tiling of 6 side unit cells along a cylinder. We used different mappings. These are just 2 of many mappings that we used, which is because we wanted to make sure that our results are not depending on the exact mapping. Because if you map the system in such a way that for that certain ground states are easily described, you have an inherent bias there and it might be hard to get rid of that. So you want to make sure that it doesn't depend on that. So we started out by calculating the ground state energies, which you do in DMRG by starting with some kind of ansatz state, then increasing the number of states by sweeping until you reach something that you consider converged. Then if you do that for a couple of different systems, you can subtract cylinders of different length to get an estimate for the bulk energy. And that's what's plotted here. We start up here, we have the mirror upper bound, which is for a valence bound crystal. Here is the CS expansion result. And here we have a variational upper bound created with a certain ansatz state by Steve White. That already shows you the scale we're dealing with here. It's not about the first digit. It's about the second or third. Down here, it becomes even closer. The green points are Steve White's science paper. The red points are our data. And as you can see, these points here agree very well, but we reached larger systems. And these 3 points actually were about as expensive in terms of CPU cycles as the remaining points together. And if you now put a fit to the last couple of points to our data and to Steve's data, it results in roughly the same energy. Ours is a bit lower, but the error bars are still there. So within the errors, it's compatible, which is good. We have a different implementation with different mapping and different ansatz states and different symmetries, and we still get the same energy. That's at least, yes?
Where is this error bar coming from, and why is it so growing so much?
There are a couple of extrapolations involved. You first extrapolate the multiplication error. With that, you could do the subtraction method. That gives you a first error bar. And then you do that for a couple of different systems. And by calculating the mean value of those, you get that error bar.
The bar
you can get a very reliable bar out of DMRG, but that's not possible for the very large systems. In principle, you can in DMRG, the Hamiltonian is formulated as a matrix product operator, which you can in principle also apply twice, which gives you the possibility to calculate H minus E squared, which is a variance. That's possible for small systems, but for these long-range interaction systems that you have in 2D, it's not possible. It just scales too badly.
But in the end, you have a variational ansatz.
Yep.
You have optimized parameters for the ansatz, and you get an exact value.
Yeah.
But that's what you are plotting there with the triangle.
Yeah.
There is no error associated to that. Whether this ansatz is a good approximation to the noun state or not, it's another question. But I'm asking whether you have any source of uncertainty, or you simply have an optimized matrix problem state for which you can exactly compute the energy.
Again, for a matrix product state that we have, we can always compute exactly the energy of this ansatz state.
Right, and this will give you some point in there.
Yeah. The error bars that we're using here come out of the extrapolation that we did before.
So you have an extrapolation. Your energy is not.
Yeah, well, we first do the extrapolation of the location error. That's the first extrapolation. Then we do this.
Right, but if you wanted to.
It's based all on.
If you wanted to look at it as a variational energy, you don't need to make any extrapolation. You have your ansatz, you optimize it, you get some energy.
Yes.
Where would it sit?
It depends on the system size. So for the smaller systems about here, it's pretty much on top of the triangles.
Right.
For the larger triangles about here, I think this one here has an energy of about 4.374.
So it would be a bit higher.
Yes.
Okay.
The truncation error, you can extrapolate. You get energies, truncation error, you can extrapolate that. But this step is the difference.
So your triangle is the result of this extrapolation.
Yeah.
So it's not variational anymore.
No, these energies here are not variational.
Okay.
The energies that we used prior to the extrapolation variation. But it's a well-controlled extrapolation. If you know what you're doing, let's put it that way. Do you remember the slide in Taiwan? You see in the truncation error, you see a scattering of points at first. And once you get closer to the actual ground state, you see a clear linear behavior. And of course, if you do the extrapolation before you have that clear linear behavior, you can get pretty much whatever you want. So people should know what they're doing before they do an extrapolation. We have energies which are comparable to white. Now let's check if we actually get the same state. So what we did first is that we checked for, valence bond crystals. White has a very nice picture in his paper where he showed the structure of the valence bond crystal, and we figured we can do that as well. So for an unconverged state, you would see a structure that actually looks like this 36-side valence bond crystal here. You would see a pinwheel about here, I think, in this sample. It disappears. This here is the difference of the bond energy to the mean bulk bond energy. So if you don't see anything, that's because the bond energy is pretty close to the bulk energy. What we see is simply that there are boundary effects which disappear within a couple of unit cells. In the middle, we have completely uniform ground state. We can also check the resonances to make sure that we're in the same state, where we add a small perturbation to the Hamiltonian and check the response of the system. So here we added a small diamond interaction, here we added a hexagon interaction, and here we added on every second bond an alternating perturbation, and we actually got the exact same number as the science paper, which again was very important. Before you do anything with your state in DMRG, you need to make sure that you are in the right state. You need to make sure that it's consistent. So once we had that, we could actually look at the spindles that we were considering. As I said, there are a couple of different proposals. Digging through the literature, you usually find some predictions based on the gauge fields. That doesn't help us in DMRG. DMRG doesn't give us access to the gauge fields directly. So we looked at them, and there are predictions which say that there's a gap, no gap, exponential or power law scaling at the correlations, that there should be certain structure in the structure factor, and that you should have a topological entanglement N2P which is finite or zero, depending on the spin liquid that you find. So this is basically what we're doing next, going through this list and checking things. Start with a gap.
Excuse me.
Yes.
What do you mean by slow decaying for the kind of, in the previous slide, you said kind of spin liquid.
Oh, I invite you to show me a paper where it says how it should behave.
Oh, no, I'm asking what do you mean by slow
decay. Oh, as far as I understand the paper, it's power law decay, what's meant.
But you're saying it's a gap system. You're saying it's a gap. Is this the absolute gap, or is it only gap in some sector?
Okay, as far as I understood the papers, the publications, there should be a gap, but the chiral correlations should decay slower than exponential, or just with a lower correlation length. The paper actually said slow decay.
Okay.
So, come.
It's if the Hamiltonian have a time of symmetry. And you also look at the chiral spin liquid, you need to have a spontaneous breaking of chiral symmetry.
Which is
so
not possible.
Z2 is broken. So maybe in the final system, the Z2 is interbreaking and slow decay. So in order to have that, the chiral correlation should be long range correlated.
Yep.
That's a
long range correlation, but how do you get that? Polynomially or exponential?
Constant.
No, the asymptotics are not zero.
Yeah.
But you can approach it.
Polynomial. Oh, sorry, exponential.
Exponential.
So the long range correlation, but the symmetry breaking state itself is gap. That's presumably should be something like that. That depends. That's a one possible chiral spin state with an entropy 1/2.
Okay.
That's
yeah, that's what we figured. I mean, no expert on the underlying theory, but we were looking for predictions. So we started out with a gap. And that's, again, one of the points where the non-abelian SU2 symmetry helps us a lot, because we can pretty much do the same thing we did for the ground state calculations. We simply flip the quantum spin number, the quantum number of spin to 1 and calculate the ground state in this sector. It's without restricted sweeping, without pinning fields. We don't need any tricks. We just need to calculate the ground state. And that gives us, here, again, the red points, fairly nice data, which actually seems to show some kind of constant behavior to the end. And that is opposed to Steve's data, where he has at least one point to that show markedly different behavior. And we think that's probably due to his procedure becoming uncontrolled for large systems. He has only access to U1 symmetry, and that makes calculation of the actual spin gap harder. Because you can't just target it, you need to do a couple of tricks to do that. And that might cause it.
Okay, so you see a stable filter gap as a function of the cylinder.
Of course, since the energies become worse for large systems, the error bar becomes bigger, but it's still stable. Next, we had to make sure that we don't have an edge excitation. So for example, if you have a single flipped spin, you would see that as a non-symmetric excitation. We have some systems where a single spin flipped around here, which caused circular response of the system around that. We didn't use those points because the spin gap was quite different. And the points we used looked like this. You have by the way, this is again bond energies. We subtracted S equals 1 from S equals 0 ground state and looked at how the pattern they made. And we see something that is symmetric to the center of the cylinder, which we figure is It's probably a sign for, we don't know what we're seeing here, but it's definitely not an edge excitation. Can tell you that much. Next was, on the checklist, was the entanglement entropy. This plot, again, I stole from Nature Physics. If you're looking at the topological entanglement entropy, it can tell you something about the information you have between the two parts of the system. If you look at an RVB spin liquid and you partition it in two parts, like these red partitions, then you can count the number of cut bonds. It will be either even or odd. And this parity can't be perturbed, destroyed, or changed by any of these resonances, which are right here, will always be an even or odd. And this extra bit of information actually reduces the effective entropy between the two parts of the system. Mathematically, this results in a universal correction to our area law. The area law means simply that the entropy scales with the surface area of the cut between the two parts of the system, plus a universal correction, which is related to the underlying topological theory. This gamma value is supposed to be 1 for a gap spin liquid and 1/2 for a chiral spin liquid. Here, we actually didn't use the von Neumann entropy, but the Rennie entropies, and that's for numerical reasons. The MRG is very good at giving us the large eigenvalues of the density matrix, but it becomes bad for the small eigenvalues simply because of numerics. There's a finite precision that we have. So the having the power of the density matrix in there suppresses the small eigenvalues, which makes them more well-behaved. And the predictions were that the topological entanglement entropy would be the same regardless of the Rennie index. So we used this generalization instead. And the way we did this was simply that we evaluated the entanglement entropy for different cylinders, and then kept the circumference constant and extrapolated in the length of the cylinder to infinite cylinder length, and then plotted those values against the width of the cylinder. And this gave us this plot. I've plotted a couple of different Rennie indices, and the smallest one is the 2, 3, 4, 5. And as you can see that for the larger Rennie indices, the curves come closer together and actually converge to more or less the same value, which is about -1, which fits in best with the Z2 spin liquid. Although, as you can see, the points are some from time to time not perfectly on the line. So 1/2 is compatible, but much worse than the value of 1 that we have here. And again, please note that this is for states that we considered very carefully. These are converged DMRG calculations. And as you can see, we didn't use the largest systems. The energy, we did up to 17 lattice spacings. Here, we can't do that. We have to make sure that the states are actually well converged in order to consider the entanglement spectrum, because that still changes for large systems.
How do we understand the points that are very close? So the circumference?
It depends on the mapping. The YC mapping is this one here. Those are always even numbers, whereas the odd, not even
so
numbers.
Different types of cylinders.
Yes. The XC cylinders always create something, some multiples of square root of 3. And at that point, they are fairly close together.
If you put just the same type of cylinder,
It's the same.
YC,
yeah.
Some number. Do you get an even better straight line? Or?
Yes. But I was discouraged from doing that because there are only a few points for every line then. And since we get the same result for more points, it makes sense to mush them all together, especially since it shouldn't depend on the mapping. It just looks a bit nicer, but the result is the same. And, well, each of those points was so expensive that we don't want to hide any data. But the fit in general is quite good, and it's definitely not zero. So we do have some topological theory here. So next we figured, let's check out if the rest works out. So we looked at the spin-spin correlations. Again, the gapless spin liquid or the algebraic spin liquid predicted a power law dk to the power of 4, which doesn't quite fit the data. Same goes for the dimer-dimer correlations, where we looked at the correlations along a line on the cylinder between different bonds. This is a bit odd, which is probably due to the periodic bounding conditions, but still not a power law decay that we're seeing here. And we also checked out the slow decay, which was supposed to happen somewhere. We checked out two different chiral correlations, one along the small triangles, which goes down fairly fast, even faster than any other correlation that we have. And then we were told that the chiral correlations are actually carried by the hexagons. So we plotted those as well. Still seeing nothing significant there. Just decays very fast. We also looked at the structure factors. For a cylinder and a torus, and the torus actually fits perfectly on the ED data that is available. And if you, for comparison purposes, here is the structure factor that Sachdev calculated from mean field theory for a gap spin liquid. And here we have the gapless spin liquid, which has a peak actually around 0, whereas ours, the blue ones, are the lowest values. So we have a minimum there. Which absolutely does not fit the proposals. So looking at our checklist again, there's only one spin liquid proposal which fits all of our data points. And that's the gap Z2 spin liquid. But even though we did look at a lot of things, there are still some open questions. For example, we're seeing this in real space correlations. On the right side, we have exact diagonalization data from Andreas Leuchli, who sees some kind of band structure around the cylinder, which is the same in every direction. Well, same in these four directions. We are seeing the same. These are isotropic, but it wipes around the cylinder.
So what is this?
This is weird space correlator, spin-spin.
Spin-spin?
Yes,
so
sorry.
You have a spin in the center?
Yeah, the black square is the reference point. The nearest neighbor I skipped because they are, well, too big. If you put them in, you don't see anything else. But starting with the next nearest neighbor is the blue circles, and then that's the rest of the structure. And considering the fast decay, it's kind of interesting that you still see it even with a circumference of, I think in this case, it's 8. Yeah. And the same is happening for the hexagonalization data, even though they have a smaller circumference. We're not entirely sure what we're seeing here. So far, nobody has come up with a good explanation of whether this is a finite size effect or an actual feature. We don't know. Also, there are more open questions, of course. What happens if you add a finite J2? How far does this spin liquid phase extend? And what is actually the underlying theory of the spin liquid? Can you determine the topological statistics? And I think people here are working on that. And of course, there's the question of, does DMRG always yield a Z2 spin liquid? There have been a couple of studies that have looked at the topological entanglement entropy. And all of them so far have found a gap spin liquid, as far as I know, which is weird. There should be other types as well. That's a.
Oh, you mean for any model that you study, whether the DMRG always gets the same?
Yeah. Have you seen anything else?
For the Ising model.
Yeah, come on. So I think that one should check that out. Looks weird at least. That's why we didn't base our conclusion simply on the topological entanglement entropy, but also checked out a couple of other things. So even with these open questions, I hope I could convince you today that the SU2 symmetric DMRG is actually a tool that can tell you a lot about two-dimensional systems, even large systems, and that if you look at enough things, you can actually determine the type of a spin liquid. In our case, we found a Z2 spin liquid based on the topological entanglement entropy, the spin gap, correlation functions, structure factors, that kind of thing. And all of these agree with the premise of a spin liquid, a gap spin liquid. So thank you for your attention.
Yeah, for this entire entropy, you calculated. And so in a larger ring entropy index, it is, I mean, should we trust the which one is better? Presumably, I think they should supposed to be the same, right?
Yes. Ideally, they should be, the slope can be different as far as I know, but they should converge to the same value.
The same point. But the what you get, they don't converge to the same point.
Yeah, but
whether you have some sense, say, which one is more reliable within the calculation?
Well, of course, the higher random indices are better for numerical reasons.
Oh, that's better for numerical reasons.
Well, simply because the DMRG gets you via numerical diagonalization, basically, the spectrum of the density matrix. And of course, you have issues with numerical precision and simply with the fact that small fluctuations occur in the orthogonalization because none of this is exact. So I think that the small eigenvalues of the density matrix are not as reliable in DMRG. So the larger any indices should be better.
Okay.
And the von Neumann entropy is much more sensitive in many ways.
I see. And but the von Neumann entropy is to be like the n go to one limit. The Neumann entropy is n go to one limit in a sense.
Yeah.
But pretty sure that the so looks like the larger one is the intersection is a one.
So
which is this a log to a log? So what is the z two legally expect? The minus one or
yeah. But this is log 2,
log
base
2. Okay. So the minus 1 is the expected loss.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we started doing the calculations in base 2. It doesn't really matter. I can do the same plot with base E. I have the full eigenvalue spectrum.
Yeah.
What I do, it doesn't really matter.
I see.
Yeah. Most literature I found used I figured base 2 was nicer.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's much more confusing. I've been asked about that a lot. I should change the plot.
Okay. And you mentioned the J2. This one without J2, right?
This is at the Heisenberg point. There's only nearest neighbor interaction.
So if you have a J, do you have anything with the J2?
I've been messing around with J2, but
I heard something like J2 may stabilize the Z2 a little bit better or something.
Yeah, this is extremely work in progress. We can talk about that tomorrow, but it's not far enough to make definite statements. There is ED data which tells us that the gap actually opens up. There's also some DMRG data which tells us that for certain system sizes and some J2, the gap opens up. But that's all I know it for so far. It's been thought that that a small finite J2 stabilizes the spin liquid, but there's no clear statement about how far it goes.
More questions?
Thanks for coming in. Thank you.